Welcome to In Between Swims, the Whitewater Podcast. I'm Jeff McIntyre. While the off-season here on the Potomac has been typical in many ways, temperatures are cold and the river's been frozen until just recently, stories of friends and friends of friends paddling in beautiful warm places are trickling in, and the occasional warm February day has caused many boaters to break out their dry tops, the off-season has brought some buzz to the kayaking world. The recent economic downturn has begun to sink its teeth into parts of the industry. Recently, Riot Kayaks appears not to exist anymore after its parent company, Voodoo Technology, filed bankruptcy in Canada. And the U.S. National Whitewater Center in Charlotte has been rumored to be facing a struggle with a potential county takeover. Many manufacturers are moving production overseas, and web-based retail continues to be a fierce competitor to your local paddle shop. While the internet is awash in rumor, guesses, opinion, and conjecture about who's doing what, where, and for what reason, one thing is sure. Times are hard, and they may get harder for the business side of the sport. While emotions are running high, especially concerning Riot Kayaks, there's an important question that doesn't seem to be being asked, and that's who's next? Will we see Dagger and Wave Sport finally combine under one name? What will the other independent kayak manufacturers like Fluid, Blistic, and Jackson do to protect their bottom line and the integrity of their business? Is the end of the local paddle shop in the near future? And what does this mean for charity donations for river conservation? How do we grow the sport when the economy seems to be working against us? So here at In Between Swims, we go back to the core, to the basic things that classify us as boaters, and to the things about boating that help define us as individuals. Regardless of your sponsorship or your lack of sponsorship, of your creek boat, play boat, squirt boat, sea boat, or river runner, whether you sweep sea to sea, back deck, or hand roll, and whether you dream of that epic glassy wave surf, or whether you regularly transition your tricky woo into a McNasty, there is a core, there is a soul, there is a special moment in a special place on a river somewhere that is the common thread for all of us. So, if it's true that you can best see the stars only when it's darkest, let's get back to the core. And in this episode, I speak with Philip Curry of Astral Buoyancy about what it was like to sell Lotus to Patagonia, some of the problems they encounter during Coast Guard certification for PFD development, and what the future of PFDs is. Shane Benedict joins us from Zwix on the Green to talk about boofing, and I catch up with Rush Sturges and Tyler Brott to review their multi-country African expedition called the Africa Revolutions Tour. Let's get started. What is your name?
I'm John Weld with the Immersion Research.
And what was your last swim?
My last swim was 1994-95 with Eric Jackson at Great Falls at Horseshoe Falls, and we you paddle with Eric and you kind of get excited about doing things maybe you shouldn't be doing. And he talks you into certain things, and we eddied out on the river left side of Horseshoe Falls, and it's pretty high for this move. It's maybe 3.5 feet somewhere in there, and we're gonna try and do a ferry, or he's gonna do this ferry across the wave and go run in the river right we're supposed to run it, and he just of course smoothed it, and I got snagged in a little hole about halfway across and ended up dropping in a horseshoe sideways and just got pounded. I mean, really scared the daylights out of me.
That's actually a really nasty spot. What was the swim out of there like?
Well, I got recirculated a bunch, and it was one of those moves where I probably recirculated 3 or 4 times before I realized that I was going to have to dive down deep to get out. And I went, as I was recircling back into the curtain, I sort of got my feet up and my head pointed the right direction, underneath me, and the water hit me, and I went straight to the bottom, and I was sort of getting pushed along the bottom, and I came up, and I flushed out, and EJ was there smiling and laughing with that EJ grin on his face.
I am joined now by Philip Curry, founder and owner of Astral Buoyancy and of the formerly of Lotus PFD Designs. Philip, thank you for joining us on In Between Swims. I'm wondering if you can tell me a little bit about how you got started making PFDs and doing the designs for PFDs.
I got into PFDs in the early 90s. At that time, there were really two PFD companies out there, Extra Sport and Stolquist. Extra Sport sort of defaulted into the market because they made a pretty nice jacket for sailors, specifically like Hobie Cat sailing and laser boat sailing down in warm waters of Florida. And then Stolquist was kind of an awkward looking PFD out of Colorado. And I got really inspired by some of the rescue PFDs that were coming out of, specifically out of Germany. HF, a guy named Horst Fuhrstall, he had a beautiful design approach. I really appreciated it. In 93, I was on a big road trip, kayaking trip out on the Payette, and a friend of mine let me borrow his HF rescue jacket, and it was just, I was amazed at how much more comfortable and just ballsy I felt. It was like, wow, I can, you know, rescue people, and I can be rescued, and this is specifically for kayakers, and it was a shortcut vest, and it was durable, and it was clean, and I was just so impressed by the product, especially when I compared it to the jacket I was wearing. So
I remember actually getting in some of your jackets right as they first came out, and after being in some of the bigger PFDs, that the fact that it was low cut, that I had a lot more flexibility with it, it was a lot easier to get a wider range of torso rotation in that. Was that by design early on? Were you guys looking to concentrate most of the volume around lower down on the torso to allow for that?
Definitely. Yeah. You know, the PFDs to that point were kind of built for people that were either standing up or sitting on the edge of a boat, or, you know, in a raft or on a canoe. And so the torso lengths were commonly long. For a kayaker, sitting with their knees up, it really shortens a torso. And just by reducing the length of the torso, which is such a key and basic, you know, design thing that we did to free up, you know, your arms and just your ability to bend forward and bend around in a kayak.
The company that you were running at the time that it came out of this was Lotus, which really got a lot of buzz. You made a decision to sell Lotus to Patagonia after a while. Was that a hard decision to make for you? What precipitated that?
It was you know, that was back in the that was like 98. Kayaking market was really on the radar, is kind of a big beacon on the radar for a lot of investors. There was that was the time that Perception sold and Dagger sold and Wave Sport. So there was a lot of buying and selling in the industry, and I was approached by, you know, many of these of those, you know, investors, and it was real easy to say no, I'm not interested. But when Patagonia expressed an interest, I was really quite honored by that, because I've always had such a high regard for Patagonia and what they do and what they stand for. So the negotiation process was certainly a long one, and had its ups and downs. And there was many times I said, no, I don't, you know, I've decided not to sell, just, you know, leave me alone. And, you know, I was 25 or 26 at the time. You know, I was just like, I don't need to sell. This is a good living. I just keep doing what I love. And that seemed to make them more hungry for it, honestly. Eventually, they just made me an offer that I just, honestly, I couldn't refuse, bottom line. So I did, you know, I took it, and I felt real comfortable that, that they would take what I had created and take it to the next level.
They've recently discontinued the Lotus line as part of their cutbacks. I mean, I think the economy is hurting everybody, and we'd certainly that blow would certainly be a lot harder felt if, after a couple of years, had you not started Astral Buoyancy. And so you're putting out a bunch of really cool jackets with Astral right now, I think. Most notably, the latest one is the green jacket, the rescue vest that you guys have. And I've been hearing about the green jacket for what seems like a year or two now before it actually right. was able to hit the shelves.
Yeah.
You and I have talked a little bit about it. One of the things that's interesting about that is, and about the manufacturing of PFDs, is that you have to go through Coast Guard certification for this. There are all these various levels of certification for vest for the Coast Guard. Talk us through that. What are the various levels? How do you deal with that certification process? What's that mean for you guys?
Well, it's you know, behind the scenes, it's one of our most complex and time consuming, you know, realities at a PFD company. There's just a ton of compliance work that has to be done. You know, when I'm designing a PFD, it all has to comply with, like you said, the Coast Guard standard, and the Coast Guard is a division of the Homeland Security, so it's just a huge bureaucratic, you know, nightmare, really. And there's a lot of sort of ambiguity in the translation of the standards that create further challenges as far as getting stuff approved. So the rescue jacket that you mentioned, the green jacket, is really our core product. It's the way I started in the business was with a rescue jacket. We've always gained a lot of interest and a lot of support when we introduce a new rescue jacket.
Now, how hard is it to get Coast Guard certification? Is this mostly just a matter of jumping through the governmental hoops, just administrative sort of stuff, or does it present design challenges for you to be able to do this?
It definitely presents design challenges. It's challenging on all the levels. It's financially challenging. It's time consumption challenging. It's challenging on an engineering level, frustration management level. It's a real challenging part of what we do. There's no question. But, you know, I will say that the Coast Guard, approval process, every time that I, you know, put a product through it, there's, there's always some good thing that comes out of it.
Give us an example. Like what?
You know, in this particular case, you know, I designed the green jacket for kayakers, specifically expert kayakers who are comfortable in class 4, 5, 6 whitewater. Typically those people are a athletic body type. You know, they have good fitness. It's designed for those types of bodies. Well, it turns out that one of the biggest challenge that we had with the green jacket was because the Coast Guard is testing for public safety, they're required to run their testing on a cross section of the U.S. population. As we all know, 60% of the population these days is obese. What happened with the green jacket in particular was there were particularly large 315-pound women, in particular, was the biggest challenge with like a double D chest size. This particular test subject was not able to fully don, to put the jacket on and buckle it within the allowed time to do that. And that is the reason why we had such a challenge approving this jacket. So, you know, what I learned is that the green jacket is not the right fit for, an obese, you know, a large person with large chest size, you know, super large chest.
What's next for you? I mean, you've had a vision for creating PFDs that were a little different than what was in the mainstream in the early 90s, and the rescue vests are always considered some of the best, if not the best, on the market. What's next for you? Where do you see kind of this part of the industry going? Is it through better kids' jackets? Is it through more women-specific sort of fits? What's the next step?
For Austral, we always try to balance maintaining our position as the design leader in the core, you know, class 4 or 5 whitewater market. So we always are pushing the envelope in those designs. We're working on a lot of stuff with different methods for adjusting a jacket and, you know, making it more simple and streamlined to fit into a jacket, eliminating snag hazards, things that kayakers, you know, in these conditions need us to focus on. And then equal to that, we're also have to focus on where the volume is in the market, and that is the recreational side. That's a much, much larger by the volume market. And we've done some extremely innovative things in there. I mean, we created the first ever breathable life jacket that we introduced last year. And actually, I would say that it's probably Astral's and my most paradigm shifting and, you know, just biggest innovation in PFDs, period. There's never been a breathable PFD until we created this one called the V8.
And that's mostly going to be oriented towards rec boaters.
It is now. You know, it is now, but we use this technology called Airscape, and it allows, you know, ventilation to come in and heat to go out. And we're going to incorporate that design element into more of our jackets, you know, across the different, you know, disciplines. So that's a big place that we're really focused now. You know, there's a lot of people that kayak in warm water in the warm weather, and, you know, we have to address their, you know, their design wishes. Environmental conditions are, you know, they're hot, and we need to give them something that they're not going to overheat in. We'll be right back.
a whitewater instructor, I often try to get students to tell me what they're going to do before they do it. Whether it's wet exiting, rolling, boofing, or some other technique they're demonstrating. Invariably, the answer I get is, well, I put my hands here, then I do this, and after that I go here, and that happens. If you've ever been chundered in a hole, or gripped at the top of a drop, you know that's not a very good mental process to come back to if you need that technique. To make your line, pull off an important roll, or just avoid a distraction like your friend who's hogging the eddy. I'm a big proponent of visualization, and hearing it laid out for you is a great way to kickstart that. I've been looking for a way to add an instructional component to the show, and Shane Benedict of Liquid Logic and John Grace of Lunch Video Magazine have come through. They've recently started a website called whitewaterinstruction.com, and I'm going to be featuring different techniques from them over the next few episodes of In Between Swims. They've even put together an instructional creaking video that I'll give you a bit more information about at the end of the show. But for now, here's Shane Benedict on How to Boof.
All different kinds of boofs. There's a straight boof, there's a straight into an eddy boof, there's a fader boof, there's a sloper into hole boof, there's a big old launcher boof. We got all kinds of options here at Zwix. So we're going to try to cover a few of the basic boofs and try to cover them well, because everybody wants to know how to boof. So the boof, the basic boof, you can break it down into a few steps, a few elements. And we're going to assume that you know the spot that you want to be, and you've picked out something that's going to give you the ability to lift the bow of the boat and land down below under control, bow up. So you want to get a nice approach where you can have a good momentum going into that move, something that's going to allow you to carry through this move where you want to go afterwards. So a good approach. The stroke is huge. It's a very critical part of this, and it's probably the most abused part of the boof. And you want to plant that stroke as you're coming to your boofing spot. Plant that stroke, pull yourself through the boof, and actually beyond. You want that stroke to carry you off the launch and towards the spot where you want to go after that. And then the body is a huge part of the boof as well. So your posture and how you sit over the boat and how you switch your edges has a big part in where you go in your boof. And then finishing that boof is getting yourself back on top of your boat, back in control, and headed in the direction that you want to go. First type of boof that we're gonna approach and talk about specifically is gonna be a straight off into the eddy basic boof. Your approach is gonna have a little bit of angle so that it carries you into the eddy. So if my eddy is on the left side as I come off of a drop, I'm gonna have right to left momentum coming to the boofing spot. A little bit of speed doesn't hurt. It's not totally necessary, but a little speed is a nice thing. And then your stroke is going to be planted in the drop right as you're coming to the rock or the wave or whatever it is you're using to boof. Pull through that launch, so pull as the boat is going up on the rock, and your stroke is still going as you pull off of the rock and clear the rock, the feature that you're trying to boof off of. And the big mistake that I see is at this point, a lot of people pull that stroke as they come into contact with the rock they're boofing or the wave they're boofing, but then they finish that stroke too early, allowing that feature to deflect them or change their direction in a way that they don't necessarily want it to do. So stay in control, hold that stroke through your interaction with that feature. That's gonna give you the ability to dictate where you go on your boof. Keep that stroke all the way through. Again, at the first drop of Zwix, we're gonna do a little different boof. We're gonna do more of a straight off boof of reverse 7 foot. We're gonna go straight out and then continue into the rest of the rapid. there's a couple little subtle changes that you'll do here. One is you can move the approach over just a little bit more so that you don't necessarily have so much right to left momentum. Move a little bit over to the left, to the paddler's left, and paddle a little more directly at the boofing spot. So carry your speed, pull your stroke, but we're going to pull that stroke really straight and we're going to stay fairly neutral over the boat. You might lean a touch towards your stroke so you get a nice plant and then land neutral over your boat. So then a third variation on the boof, a really fun move that we also do at reverse 7 foot is what we call a fader. And what we're going to do is actually come off of that boof and instead of going into the eddy or going straight, we're going to actually try to really fly it off to the right. And we use this a lot when we're boofing off of a drop that might have a rock sitting right where you normally would land. Or it's the only direction we can sort of boof, but then we need to turn right. We need to land and be going to the right-hand side of the river. And the big difference here is you're going to, as you go off that boof, you're actually going to lean a little more aggressively. And instead of your stroke being a straight pull, you're going to actually lean out a little bit and pull almost a draw. So you're going to change your forward stroke to, instead of, say, putting it in at 12 o'clock, we're going to stick it in out there, maybe even almost 2 o'clock, and pull from there. And that's going to pull the boat sideways. And in conjunction with that curling wave or that rock or whatever it is you're going off of, those two things working together are going to really drive the bow right quickly. Now, the hard part is you've leaned out off of your boat. Now what you need to do is, as you finish that stroke and pull off the drop, pull that last part of that stroke so that you can get the boat back underneath you and then go on in the direction that you want to go, under control, in balance.
And I am happy to welcome Rush Sturges and Tyler Brott with to In Between Swims, the Whitewater podcast. They are joining me today via Skype from out on the West Coast. And I dropped Rush email the other day when I saw the trailer for the new Africa Revolutions film that they've got coming out, the video. I'd kept up with the trip when they were doing it, and they were doing some pretty cool stuff. Rush, Tyler, thank you guys for hanging out with us today.
Thanks for having us, Jeff.
I want to start off with kind of the good karma aspect of this. You tell us a little bit about what the Africa Revolutions tour was. What were you guys doing over there?
Well, I mean, essentially, it's just it was a standard kayak mission. We're going over there to explore the southern cone of Africa and, you know, find as much hard whitewater as we can while documenting it the whole time. But kind of the different angle on this one was to help promote the Sun Catchers Project, which is a nonprofit organization designed to implement solar cooking and solar technology into rural areas of Africa.
There's certainly a need for that there. When I was in Uganda last year, I was looking at the solar panels that Soft Power Health uses, and it just kind of amazed me that there's so little use of solar there while they're putting the dam up on the White Nile. Do you guys generally get a good reception to that while you were over there?
Yeah, the reception that we had was great. I think that a lot of people were excited to see us coming through, doing something new and different, and really promoting something that could be really beneficial to a lot of people in Africa. You know, not a lot of the local African folks had seen any type of solar cooking or water purification devices before, which are basically just solar ovens. So we were very well received pretty much everywhere we went in Africa.
Let's get to the boating. You guys are running some pretty amazing stuff over there, stuff where the dangers aren't necessarily in the rapids, but in terms of wildlife, and you guys were getting up actually in some of the areas around the Lord's Resistance Army. What did you guys know going into this? Had there been other expeditions in the area, kind of starting off with the Murchison Falls section that you guys did?
Yeah, well, Tyler had actually done Murchison Falls a couple of years before. He was on, I think, the second or third, the second expedition to go in there. So I think we were actually the fourth or fifth expedition going in there. And actually, 6 months before we went in, a group of Germans had an incident in there that we heard about. And it's all kind of in the rumor mill, but supposedly somebody was attacked by a crocodile, or their boat was was attacked, and nobody got hurt, but supposedly they were helicoptered out of the section. So it's a very, very dangerous stretch of whitewater for more reasons than one. You know, the wildlife, obviously, a huge factor. But then also, like as you mentioned, the Lord's Resistance Army, and this is a section that other people, other Westerners, someone was killed in there a few years ago on the same section. So it's definitely really sketchy, and we knew that going in there. But it was we were there, and it was the right time, right place, right group, and we went for it.
What sort of flows are we talking about on this section? When I think of the White Nile, certainly I'm thinking of pretty high volume stuff, but are you guys running this at peak flows? What sort of CFS would you estimate was running there at the time?
Right. Well, the interesting thing about this trip down the Murchison section was that the river was actually running a little bit lower than when I had gone in there before, just because they're releasing a lot less out of the dam. I expect that there was, somewhere around 125,000 CFS in the river, so it's still really big volume, but the low flows threw us off a little bit. The rapids had changed, a lot of things were different, and my memory proved to be not as good as I thought it was going to be going in there, so it definitely contributed to making some interesting situations at many different points during the expedition.
Give us an example. When you say interesting situation, is this mostly from just trying to remember your line, or what are the variables that you're dealing with, you're talking about?
Going down that river, a lot of different things can occur. There's two main portages during the run. One is at go right, and the other one is down at go left, or it's called the zoo by some people. And yeah, dropping into go right was a really really scary situation. It's a completely unrunnable rapid, and you have to catch an eddy above it, and basically figuring out where that eddy is can be a little bit tricky to do that, and then find the portage trail. And it didn't help that we got chased to the lip of the rapid by a crocodile, and then had to start kind of carefully making our way down along the bank to try to figure out the portage. That was one of the scariest situations for me, and it's definitely, it's the type of run that it'd be very difficult to do without any previous knowledge of it. So I felt very fortunate that we were just all able to pull off that expedition, and that all the boys got to the bottom safe and sound.
It sounds like a horrible place to swim. I mean, other than just the pure volume of it, but in terms of having to deal with the wildlife factor as well. Were there swims? Do you guys have any issues with that at any time?
Yeah, we had a pretty we had several very scary incidents with the wildlife. And the most difficult part about this river is that it's 80 kilometers long, the section, and it's divided into all these channels. So you're navigating these channels, and almost every eddy on there has hippos or a pod of hippos. It's like the highest concentration of hippos in the world. So you're dealing with that. You know that if you swim, you're going to end up with some wildlife, whether it's crocodiles, or there's water buffalo, there's elephants, there's all sorts of stuff in there. It's like you're on a safari. So we had one incident where a lot of the times we were bombing these channels blind because it's hard to get out of your boat. Sometimes it's riskier to try and get out on land and scout something than it is to just run it. So we were getting towards the end of our run, almost finished, and we could actually see the takeout just above Murchison Falls, and it's quite serious whitewater through there. And Tyler led us into this rapid, which turned out to have a really big ledge hole in it, and Lane was following not too far behind, and went into this mammoth hole and got beat down pretty violently, and ended up swimming, and he popped up right next to me and grabbed onto the back of my boat, and we paddled into this eddy and basically paddled right over two massive hippos that were sitting in the eddy. And, Lane was just like screaming obscenities at the top of his lungs and just, freaking out. And I think that was actually a really good thing, because it startled the hippos, and they were so startled by us that they moved away. And then when we got them to shore, we turned around and two huge hippos popped up like just where we had been. So it was, that was high stress for sure.
You guys moved on out of after the Murchison Falls section that you ran, and you were trying to hit a couple of other countries. According to the blog, you guys got turned back at Zimbabwe due to border issues as well. Where did you head to from there?
Well, the Murchison Expedition was actually the final expedition of the trip. We started in Uganda, bought our vehicle, drove down all the way through Kenya, Tanzania, Zambia to the Zambezi River, and then down through Botswana and South Africa to Durban, South Africa, where we picked up most of the crew early in January 2008. And that's kind of where the proper mission began. We then toured South Africa and Lesotho before flying over to Madagascar, coming back and then retracing our route back up through Botswana, Zambia, Tanzania, Kenya, and then to Uganda where we did the Murchison Expedition.
Let's talk about Madagascar for a few minutes. That, in reading your blog, that comes across as one of your favorite places. You compare it to the whitewater in California or Norway. What's great about Madagascar?
Madagascar, like New Zealand or California or Norway, it's coastal mountains and it's a lot of granite. It's pretty unique in that sense that it has a really abundant amount of white water. Like when it rains there's just water everywhere, and it's super unexplored, so it's a really exciting place driving around there. You don't really know what you're going to find every day. And it got to the point towards the end of the trip where the rivers are so clean and so classic there that we were just picking different points on a map and dropping into these rivers and just finding super epic stuff, and just a cool place to travel. Definitely, as far as the entirety of the film, Madagascar is for me it's the highlight. It's where we had a lot of our found most of our whitewater and most of our action at.
When I think of, well, New Zealand certainly, but when I think of those sort of islands that have whitewater like that, that run straight into the ocean, where you have huge amounts of gradient, I tend to think more Creekin. I mean, certainly running the Nile and the Zambezi, that's going to be higher volume stuff. What were the rivers like in Madagascar? You guys mostly run in pool drop stuff? Is it slides? What are you doing?
Madagascar just has a full spectrum of rivers, from the rivers that drain off the east to the west side of it. It has big volume, really intense, big rapid rivers on it. It's got steep creeking, waterfalls, pool drop rivers. I mean, you can really find a very wide spectrum of whitewater in Madagascar. I think that some of the stuff that we did on that trip that was most exciting was the steeper creeks, pool drops, and just finding some really great big waterfalls and rivers which hadn't been explored before. That's the other exciting thing about Madagascar, like Rush was saying, is that hardly anybody's been in there, and it's just amazing. I think that we can both say that some of the most amazing first ascents we've ever done in our lives were on the island of Madagascar.
One of the other things that stands out in the trailer that I saw for the Africa Revolutions video is the time on the Zambezi. Now, I remember seeing the videos from back in the day of Wicked Liquid and stuff and being just amazed at this huge volume river. But you guys went and tackled this huge volume river when there was a lot more volume going on with it. Talk a little bit about your approach and your experience on the Zambezi on this.
It's definitely pretty terrifying experience. It was really fun, though. I think one of the cool things we have going in the video is that when Tyler and Aaron were coming down south, they stopped on the Zambezi when it was at lower water. And so we have a segment of the low water in the video. Mm-hmm. And then when we come back later in the video, it's running at, ridiculous flow, estimated between a quarter and a half a million CFS, all in this pretty boxed-in gorge. When we got there, I'd never run the river before. I hadn't been to Zambia, but Tyler had run it just twice at low water. It was really scary because nobody around town would go with us. There's a few local paddlers there, and they all told us, like, people hold you to pretty high standards there, and they're like, oh, of course you'll go and run the gorge, we weren't really sure about it. It was looking at it was really big, and none of us knew the lines, so we actually got Nico Chasing to help us out a little bit, and he sort of drew some pictures, and because once you're in there, you're going, you're not scouting at all. It's pretty much, balls to the wall for the whole entire section. So we kind of had an idea of what was in there, but we basically ran the entire thing pretty much blind.
Again, what sort of CFS are you talking about? I mean, running the Zambezi at flood, that just sounds huge. I'm imagining, reactions coming off of the walls and whirlpools and all sorts of crazy stuff going on.
Yeah, it is just absolutely wild, that river. It's also very constricted, and the river itself does a few zigzags as it goes through the canyon. And so there's just upwelling of very deep currents. It's very erratic. There's nothing predictable. And yeah, like you say, there's just boils, seams, whirlpools, everything that you could possibly imagine about a river that large constricted into what it is. And so, yeah, it was a really scary experience, especially, like Rush says, never having been down there before, and then just being taken down by eddy lines, you know, and not knowing exactly what's downstream or, you know, even what the rest of the rapid has in store for you. So I think that, that was definitely one of the, climaxing scary points on the trip. I know that we were all gripped. It's the only time that I've ever had to, we had one little section in that river where it got calm enough that we were able to get to the bank, and my legs were shaking so much that I had to get out of my kayak and crank up my footrests a few notches so that my legs were so tight in there that they didn't have any room to shake. It was wild, wild time.
I got to believe that one of the risks in that, other than, you know, the what we would imagine, the whirlpools and the seams and just kind of the craziness going on, would be skirt implosion. Did you guys take any, were you using, plastic overthrusters, beach balls, anything like that to help you with the possibility of having your skirt implode?
Yeah, we had some life jackets between our legs. And, that's definitely the biggest risk in there is, imploding a skirt, because I mean there's some sections in there, most parts of that of the section, if you swim, it's going to be really, really bad news. And that was definitely a big risk. It was a little bit better the second day, because we the first day we really didn't know what to expect at all, and then but the second day we had a helicopter there filming, and not that would really do that much if you did swim, but it is a little bit comforting, I think.
Cool. Africa Revolutions is the video. If people are interested in checking it out, where do they go? How do they get hold of a copy? How do they see it?
Well, we're just launching the film right now, putting a wrap on it, hopefully here in the next few days. And yeah, the film is looking absolutely spectacular. I encourage everybody to watch it if they get a chance. It has a lot of amazing scenes of Africa, a lot of the Suncatchers project in it. And the film will be available online. Revolutionary Innovations has a website coming up. It's rev-inn.com, rev-inn.com. And the film will be up there. Everybody should check out the Suncatchers website, which is the suncatchersproject.org. Film will also be up there on the Suncatchers site.
And we're going to have also, we've got a totally original soundtrack for this movie. So we're going to have some of the songs available for download off of the website as well. So be sure to check that out.
Thanks to Philip Curry of Astral Buoyancy for taking the time to be on the show. His is a story I've been wanting to tell on In Between Swims for a long time. Look them up at astralbuoyancy.com. A major thanks to Shane and John and Will at LVM. Their new instructional video, Steep Creek Skills, is now available at whitewaterinstruction.com. You can also catch the video of the audio you heard here at that website. And if you haven't heard the new podcast from LVM, I'd recommend checking it out too at lvmvideo.com. Finally, I'm thankful I was able to catch Rush and Tyler in country and appreciate the time they gave for the show. Their new video, Africa Revolutions, should be out soon. If you go to revin.com, that's rev-inn.com, you can catch a preview of the film there. It's pretty epic. Thanks to everyone that's left a comment at the show's iTunes page. I'm still trying to push the show's visibility up through the iTunes ranks. So if you listen or subscribe to this show via iTunes, please stop by the In Between Swims page there and leave a comment. That'll help get whitewater paddling a bit more recognition apart from the bass fishers, gun reviewers, and paintballers. Music today is from Rhino Bucket, Nine Inch Nails, and Malawian Esau Mwemwaya. If you have any questions, comments, or ideas for the show, drop me an email at inbetweenswims@yahoo.com. I'll have a special request for our listeners for the next episode that I'll be posting on the blogs and the message board soon. Keep an eye out for it. Until then, I'm Jeff McIntyre, and I'll see you on the river.